The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. At this point, I'm sure you think you know all about Senator Amy Klobuchar, but you may not know how full her plate actually is. She not only chairs the Senate Rules Committee and the Democratic Steering and Outreach Committee, but she also chairs the Judiciary Subcommittee on Competition Policy, Antitrust, and Consumer Rights. In fact, this past February, she introduced the Competition and Antitrust Law Enforcement Reform Act of 2021. And this brings us to the reason we're all here this evening. In her New York Times bestselling book, Antitrust, Taking on Monopoly Power from the Gilded Age to the Digital Age, Senator Klobuchar offers a thorough history of America's fight against monopolies as a guide to curtailing contemporary monoliths like Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Big Pharma. Tonight, she'll be in conversation with Mark Zandi, Chief Economist, Moody's Analytics, author of Paying the Price, Ending the Great Recession and Beginning a New American Century. Thank you for joining us. The screen is yours.
Thank you, Andy. I want to thank you and the Free Library for the opportunity to be with you. And welcome, Senator Klobuchar. It's good to be with you. It's too bad we can't be at the Free Library in person.
Yes. Yeah. Very good. Well, thanks, Mark. I appreciate that. I love Philadelphia. Spent a lot of time there, good friends there, including Bob Casey, who's one of my best friends in the Senate, actually. Also, I'm excited to talk about this because there's so much history in my book about the founding of our country and where the founding fathers were when it came to monopolies, which was pretty interesting. And just the relevance of all of this to today. So thanks for doing this and thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And let me begin by saying that I very much enjoyed your book. It's very thoughtful and I have to say extraordinarily thorough. I think I 150 pages of endnotes. I think it's in five font. Am I okay, exaggerating?
No, that's correct. I'm only laughing because my husband is in this room with me right now. And as I say in the book, he did a lot of the research and we had no researcher. He's a law professor and he wrote the footnotes. And then for the good of our marriage, I could not eliminate any of the footnotes. So, but the his joy in hearing that you led with a comment on the footnotes knows no parallel. So that is
That is massive. It's massive. Yeah. But I'll to tell your husband though, I to be frank, I couldn't get through all of them.
Okay. He accepts that. He accepts that.
Okay. So let me ask you this. How in the world did you write a book like this, which is obviously, you know, takes a lot of energy, just if you were doing that on its own, your day job is being senator. You're on, Andy listed the committees you're on. You're on a lot of committees, and you ran for president, and you got really far in the campaign. Congratulations!
Astounding many critics. No, I'm kidding. Just like the book. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, how
do you? I actually, first of all, I've lived and breathed this for a while, and we'll talk about my family and my work. Actually, I represented MCI a long time ago, which was when they were really taunting the monopolies to get into the market. And I then, you know, get to the Senate. I'd done a lot of work on it. So I knew a lot about it, even though I was, you know, no law professor myself, let me say. And so then I got interested in writing it about 2 years before the presidential race. So the history part of it, I had written on my free time leading into it. And I also don't get a lot of sleep. So then during the presidential, it sort of was a little bit on hold. And then when that ended, sadly for me. But when that ended, I really started gearing up on the more modern parts of the book. So that actually worked out because so much has happened in the last year with the lawsuits during the Trump administration at the end against Google and against Facebook, with the rise of interest in this issue on really both sides of the aisle. And so it actually worked to make it more relevant, I think, because that I was writing up until the very end of the last deadline. And then I got the Biden getting elected in there. And so all that, you know, was the last few months. So I think it actually worked out pretty well. So it was in sort of in two places and we got it done. So.
Well, somehow I think you're going to have another crack at the presidential race. So I don't think you've got more there to go. You know, you are obviously very accomplished, but I also just want to point out to the audience that you're an incredibly nice person. You probably don't remember this. I'm sure you don't remember this, but I do. I testified in the Joint Economic Committee. I don't know, might have been 4, 5, 6 years. I can't even remember. You know, a while ago, and there was a recess, I guess, for a vote, but you didn't need to go for some reason. So you stayed and you took me around with the other witness. It was Kevin Hassett, I believe, from AEI.
Right, who Republican witness, yep.
Mm-hmm. He was ultimately Trump's CEA yes. director, right? Yeah. And you took us, because it's in a beautiful, large venue, and there was a library. And I remember you taking us back into the library and you gave me a history lesson back then too, as I recall. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I love history, but I think it's really important to bring people into it. And that's why I led that way with our book, because you can't just start afresh with American, as you know, being a star economist, you can't just start like today. Well, this is what we should do. Understanding how we got to where we are is really important part of figuring out how we go forward.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, that was incredibly disgracious of you, and I remember that with great fondness. So nobody does that. I mean, that was very nice of you.
Hey, yes, I have a habit of taking my constituents, especially on all kinds of hilarious secret rooms and balconies and Schumer. Right? There's a secret window you can get out overlooking. I'm always saying to his guy, "Hey, could we open that up?" And then bring him out there. There's a lot of great things in the Capitol. So. I just got Senator Padilla's little kids. I showed them a secret door that opens up. You can kind of dramatize it, let me say, with kids. But all right. Yeah,
they enjoyed it. I'm sure they really enjoyed it. Hey, there's one thing in your bio that I'm hoping you can help me with. Okay, so you went to Yale undergrad,
yeah,
right? And then you got your law degree at the University of Chicago. Great university. Great university, not the University of Pennsylvania, mind you, but you know, pretty good universities. And of course, Robert Bork, a bit of an antagonist in your book, and obviously a very well-respected scholar who had a lot to say about antitrust, wrote a very famous book on antitrust, was a professor at Yale, and then Chicago. University of Chicago is kind of like ground zero for the intellectual basis for, kind of Borkian thought on antitrust. So
it really is. But I think that was good for me, actually. It was really good to go from Yale to Chicago because there were a number of professors still there, of some like Posner, who plays a major role in antitrust. Easterbrook was there when I was there. Scalia had just taught there. So you really got a sense of the different views of antitrust. And my argument here is it's just so interesting that we're seeing many Republicans come around to saying, you know what, we believe in entrepreneurship and small business. This isn't working very well. Well, that's good. But part of the problems that we got to where we are is this Bork theories, in which he constructed this new view of antitrust, which I don't think was very originalist. I think it was the opposite. It was kind of radical. Instead of looking at, Senator Sherman, who is a Republican, put together the Sherman Act, which, of course, the first president that made a big deal out of it was a Republican, Teddy Roosevelt. And that the intent was to further competition and to help consumers and to promote entrepreneurship, small businesses. Bork turns it over on its head in his theory and the paradox of antitrust paradox, turns it on its head, turns it into something called consumer welfare standard, which he says includes efficiency and basically also protecting monopolies. I'm sort of vaguely describing it, which I do in more detail in the book. Then that theory is what's used by people like, and honestly, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, certainly Clarence Thomas and others over time, to the point where there was one time where there was 15 cases that the plaintiffs were zero for, no wins. And it's very hard to advance those antitrust cases right now in court because of the precedents that's been set. So that's led me to be a realist, say, well, we can't wait 20 years or 50 years. Maybe they'll change some of their precedents. They had a recent tech case that they indicated, at least Justice Kavanaugh did, a change. But if that is stays static, we've got to do something about, one, upping enforcement, of course, and two, looking at changing the laws. And it's not radical. Over time, the Sherman Act was followed by the Clayton Act, which was followed by a number of other bills that would respond to the moments of our time. And because of monopoly lobbying, because of just people just hard to understand, as we know from those hearings, we've just done nothing. We don't have a federal privacy law, unrelated, but sort of related to antitrust. We don't do any, haven't done anything in the app stores, which is this whole new ecosystem, which is almost replacing the web in terms of how people spend their time 4 hours a day buying stuff. We haven't done stuff about the fact that these companies have become these gatekeepers, as pointed out by my friend David Cicilline and Jerry Nadler, leaders over in the House on their investigation. And we are going to have to pass some bills to respond to the sophisticated, our laws should be as sophisticated as the companies we're supposed to regulate, and that hasn't happened.
Yeah. So, but going to Yale and University of Chicago, which are the kind of the vast—
I kind of took you off the question. I was, that's called segueing back. Yes.
It's fascinating to me that you kind of, I mean, I guess you're saying I learned from that. I got to know that argument so well. You can understand, you know, what was the flaws in that argument? What was wrong with that argument?
I think so. And that's why being at Chicago, that really, I mean, I had classes from a number of the key conservative thinkers, and also were at school with my peers. Some of them have gone on to be professors. And it really tests you and makes you think about, what is this argument? Does it really work with the whole law and economics theory, as you know, that has been coming out of Chicago. And I also had professors like Cass Sunstein, who is my law review advisor, and Jeff Stone, who were clearly not of the same philosophy, and were very well known and amazing people.
Right. Do you think your interest in this, this kind of the antitrust, anti-monopoly, looking out for entrepreneurship, small business, is rooted in some way in your life in Minnesota, in the upper Midwest? I mean, do you think you can connect the dots back to that in some way?
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, if you look back at your past and your own maybe grandparents, more like that time, great grandparents, it's all been rooted in this economic march for our country. And since we're in Philadelphia, you know, thinking about how it all started and thinking about Adam Smith, who was known as the father or godfather of capitalism with his theories and the invisible hand, all, you know, read at that time, he always was warning about what he called the standing army of monopolies. And then you look at Jefferson and Madison involved in major discussions about whether or not something should be included in the US Constitution on monopoly. And ultimately, it really wasn't. But there's all this language in the Constitution about basically ripping themselves away from England and their monopoly power. They don't use those words, but that's a lot of what was going on. The Boston Tea Party was, yes, about taxation without representation, but it was also about they didn't want to buy their tea from the monopolist East India Tea Company. And you march through, then it takes about 100 years where farmers and workers are getting really pissed off because all their stuff has to go on one train, or, you know, they have to buy one kind of beef, and they end up, their union startup. Farmers are out there with pitchforks, the Granger movement, and out of that comes this Sherman Act and other things. But for me, my own grandpa, his own parents came over from Slovenia, And he grew up, my dad's dad, in a family of 10. And the parents were pretty sick. His dad worked in the mines. He worked in the mines for Monopolist, basically. And they lived in company housing. And when his dad died really young and his mom, he was the oldest son. He ended up raising the rest of them with my grandma, who he married. And at some point, my grandma decided, we've had two generations of Klobuchars working for these Monopolists. My son is going to be a concert pianist. Okay, he didn't do that, despite her getting a piano for 10 bucks. But he became a newspaper man. And we just lost him last week, actually. But my dad spent his career as a newspaper columnist, really taking on the causes of those on the outside. So I was really steeped in a lot of this growing up. And my mom would drive me by James J. Hill's famous house in St. Paul, which was this huge mansion, at Christmas. And of course, he was long dead. But she'd go by and she'd say, you know, your grandpa built that house. Well, he didn't actually build it. But by a fluke, my great grandpa arrived the same year it was being built. And the point was more of a metaphor that, you know, the working class built this house and built things for Monopolists. And I represented business after that. I went to law school. I came back to Minnesota. I worked in the private sector, and I have a very healthy respect for capitalism. But I also know, if history is a guide, we have stood up and put some bumpers on all of this and safeguards to make sure we keep furthering competition. And that just hasn't been happening in the last few decades.
Yeah. So I started my own company back 30 years ago, an economic consulting firm, right out of grad school. I went to Penn, you know, as you can imagine. I'm a Philly, a Philly boy. You know, this is, my kids joke that I've been sheltering in place all my life. So I'm not. And then it turned into a pretty good size small business. I had about 100 employees before I sold it to Moody's about 15 years ago. So I've been a startup, I've been a small business owner, and I've been a part of a large multinational corporation. And Moody's is massive, you know, massive corporation. And, you know, I miss the days of being an entrepreneur. I really do. But I do have a lot of respect for large companies, you know, like a Moody's. You know, there is a lot of competition. They're not these monolithic organizations. There's many things going on with inside of them. And at least in my part of the world within Moody's, the competition is fierce. So I guess my question with that as a preface, and just, that's just my experience. What is it, big bad? Is it inherently bad that we have big companies?
Not necessarily, no. I think what you've got to look at, and what we have looked at throughout history, is there competition? And you can also have companies, let's say tech, Facebook or Google, that gave us incredible products. Amazon, during the pandemic, I get all this. They gave us some incredible products. I'm not arguing to get rid of them by any means. I think we should be proud of these American companies. We should be proud of the people they employ. But that doesn't mean that at some point you say, wait a minute, we don't have any privacy rules. And you guys have been saying, trust us, for a long time. It isn't working. Cambridge Analytica, 87 million people hurt. Okay, it's not working. And so how would this work? Well, one, you can get regulations in place. Monopolies made that hard to do because elected officials get scared of them and they do whatever they want. Look at pharma with insulin prices, or with, you know, what happened with EpiPen when there were few competitors. So you want rules of the road in place, sometimes industry specific, things you can do for competition with pharma. There's a lot of them, sometimes broader. The second thing is unleashing the power of capitalism to allow new companies to develop these bells and whistles. That's what has happened in the past. You know, even these, even like Apple, some of these companies came into being when there was pauses in the market on IBM or other places. They came into being because there was maybe not in the end a big antitrust result, but there was enforcement and things going on. And so what's happening now is, we'll never know if WhatsApp or Instagram could have developed the bells and whistles for privacy, because Mark Zuckerberg, in his own words, said, "I'd rather buy than compete." That was in an email. He said, these are nascent companies, but their brands are meaningful. And this is an exact quote. One day they could be disruptive to us. Mm-hmm. Tech should be all about disrupting. Competition should be about disrupting. And when you start having a situation where there are gatekeepers that can stop the disruption by just buying them out, I think you have a problem down the road. So it is no longer just an esoteric topic when you've got, you know, online travel over 90% owned by two companies. They just have all these different names and you don't know it. You've got everything from sunglasses to cat food to my favorite John Oliver example, who they used on a show where he said, if you're tired of all this consolidation, good luck, because there's only three casket makers left.
All that. Yeah,
well, it's down to two. One bought the other. So,
oh,
you know,
I missed that. Oh, geez.
No, they did. Yes, I guess it sort of makes it even better story. But the point is that you want to encourage competition. I'm not talking about destroying these companies. I'm saying, well, look what we did with AT&T. That actually worked. AT&T was a horizontal monopoly in that it owned all the phone service. And then it was a vertical monopoly because it owned all the equipment underneath it. The government over Democratic and Republican administration, reminding me a little of the Trump starting the suits in his administration, and then you move to Biden, it's continuing him. They broke up AT&T, and Allen, the former chairman himself, said that they were a stronger company because of it. Long distance prices went down, and guess what? We got cell phones that went from the size of Gordon Gekko's briefcase in the movie Wall Street to where we are right now. And so that is a textbook case of everyone thought, well, hey, AT&T's given us great things. Oh, this could be bad for security if we do this. There were all kinds of arguments made of why we should just keep them as one monolithic company. The good products and the ideas aren't going to go away. We just want to have more competition to get more new ideas, and especially with what we're facing right now, new consumer protections that can be added to products.
Right. Makes a lot of sense. So I am an economist, and so I do focus on data. Mm-hmm. And one thing that confuses me a bit, and I'm just curious, you know, how you think about this, is kind of a classic way a monopolist takes advantage is higher prices, higher inflation. But the reality is that for the last almost quarter century, inflation here in the United States has been very low. In fact, the Federal Reserve would say, hey, too low. You know, it's been below their 2% inflation target. So, and I know you can, there are cases where monopolists have taken advantage and you can, you know, find them where they raise prices. But in broad macroeconomic terms across the economy, you don't see that kind of inflationary pressure. So how do you square that circle?
Okay. So first of all, there are monopolists. They often do increase prices because they can, but they often don't do it for quite a while because they know they're going to get caught and that's going to make people want to do stuff. So pharma is a classic example where I lead my book with a story that happened in my state first when pharmacists started calling me. One company bought a life-saving infant heart drug. There was only one other competitor on the market. They bought the second one, and then that company jacked up the prices from $85 a treatment to $1,600 a treatment. It is the classic, and it seems to happen in pharma a lot.
Okay.
However, you can have other cases where, yeah, prices are low on some of these, well, Amazon, for instance. You can get deals, things like that. But once you have a monopoly, they have the market power, as you know, to increase a price. You just don't know when it's going to happen. And that's why traditionally economists like competition. They don't want to have it all in the hands of one or maybe two that they call a duopoly. The third thing I'd argue, especially in this really sophisticated economy, that some of the things we're looking for right now, like bells and whistles on privacy or on misinformation, there are things people want as part of these products that aren't all about price. There are a decaying of the quality. Let's call it a quality of a product. Seems really cool when you go on the your app store, you can buy stuff, but then the quality of the product has problems because your information's going to go out there. You don't understand what you're signing up for. And then the final thing, I just made these up as we go, so I'm not like you with your economic list, but here's a real good one. So, you know, the app stores, they say, oh, wow, 85% of these are free. So let's go over this, the app store primer, which, by the way, I didn't know much about until Apple refused to send a witness at first, they finally did, to a hearing Mike Lee and I were chairing together, was totally bipartisan, about a month ago. And then he and I had to decide whether or not we were going to really take this on to do a letter to push them, that they had to give us some witness. And he and I spent a weekend learning all about this. And now we're really trouble on this because it's very annoying and it's really bad. So what it is that Apple has the app stores for the app for the Apple phones. Google dominates the app stores for everyone else. There's still a web, but a lot of people are buying stuff on apps. So you have this two separate monopolies. A lot of the people get to be on their apps for free, but there's a whole bunch of companies set by the rules by Apple and Google who have to pay, when you go on there, 30% of what you pay for something, Spotify, Match.com, they were our witnesses, Tile, goes to one of the monopolists. And so when you talk about pricing, Spotify would love to tell everyone, hey, you can get a lot better deal on our website, but they're banned from doing it. Mm-hmm. They also keep noting, well, why doesn't Uber have to pay these? Why do we? And they literally couldn't really explain that. Mm-hmm. But we keep going back to, yeah, because there's Apple Music. Mm-hmm. And so the final bad thing was that the night before the hearing at Google, business person, we're getting to the bottom of this, actually called up little match.com. They're not that little, but it's just such a funny thought, and said, hey, that testimony your guy's going to give tomorrow, that seems different than what you said in your shareholder report. Okay, that's what monopolists do. And they feel like they have the power to do that. They were going to all pick up their marbles and leave Facebook and Google, the entire country of Australia, because they were going to try to charge them for content. And there was so much worldwide pressure, they couldn't do that. So I think there are some legitimate things going on, like news content, that maybe it's not all immediately about price, but the effect of it, or misinformation about the vaccines, or how about the insurrection and the election. There's such bad stuff going on related to these products that there's a reason to take on monopolies in addition to price.
Got it. So in the case of particularly tech, it may not be about price. It may not even be about the products that they provide. We love Amazon. We love Apple. We love Google. They provide.
I've got the iPhone. Got my Fitbit. I'm not some, you know, as Mike Lee would say, caveman.
Exactly. But it's about, in this case, about the control they have over information, that they have monopolistic power over information.
It's part of it. Yes. Yeah. There's many things going on. Yes.
Yeah. So then the question becomes, in the case, tech is complicated, right? Because, you know, it's not bad that they get rewarded because they provide really good stuff and services, and we're happy with that. But at the same time, they are contributing. We all feel very uncomfortable with what's going on with regard to information and how they are managing our data and our, you know, privacy. And it just doesn't feel like it's working for us. So how do we solve that problem? I mean, it's not, you do a nice job of kind of laying out what we could do. Like, we could regulate, we could use antitrust to bake them up, but neither of those, like the Europeans are trying regulation. That doesn't seem to be going so well. Antitrust, I'm asking you,
okay, so, well, Europe can't do it alone. And I think there's growing international concern about this. And they just happen to be out front first. The first thing I'd say is we need to up our work in our agencies. You can't take on the biggest companies the world has ever known to put in place whatever you want with them to make it better for the consumer. You can't do that with duct tape and Band-Aids. And so Grassley and I just had a major, major victory in this isn't just about tech. It's for FTC and the Department of Justice antitrust in getting our bill through the Judiciary Committee on this last Thursday with unanimous support. It would add about $130 million between these two agencies to hire the lawyers they need, and not on taxpayers' back, but by charging higher fees on mega mergers. So that's the first thing. And then I would do other things with appropriations. The agencies are literally a shadow of their former self during the Reagan administration. Second thing you can do, and this, the first thing is pretty straightforward. Second thing, upgrade our laws and make sure that they match the times. And I've got a number of things. The third are things outside of, and that's antitrust. Outside of antitrust, which I would put in a larger rubric of competition policy, which I think we'd be better off calling it anyway. And that's things like immigration reform to create more competition and small business and new ideas. It's things like making sure that employees can freely move between companies with limits at the higher end, but certainly not in Jimmy John's employees with non-compete agreements. It is things like making sure we're investing in small businesses and minority and women-owned small businesses. And all of it is geared at improving the competitive landscape in America.
Got it. Hey, have you heard about this proposal for middleware to put middleware being, this is a proposal someone wrote in the Council of Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs. And middleware is software that would sit on top of the platforms, the Facebook platforms, that would filter the information in a way that you, the user, would determine. So the Google and Facebook would not do that. You would do that. But that's not something that's crossed your radar screen.
No, I've heard the name and, you know, I'll look at it. I just think any products that can give the consumer control. Also, should we be tech, when they use our data, right now they use it without us consenting a lot of times because we don't have plain language and there's all kinds of privacy bills. But when they use the data, maybe they should be paying us for it, either paying the country as a whole, the taxpayers, because we're like little profit centers. And then I think this idea is more geared at, which is good, at just giving you more control over what you see. You have the whole algorithm issue, which has, of course, led to more people getting more extreme content because that gets more popular on both sides. And for those of us that try to work on solutions in the middle, that makes it much harder for our whole government to function. So it has contributed to so many issues here that, and while we have all sat back, the government and everyone else, and said, okay, we'll trust these guys, elected officials don't understand this, so there you go. And I just think there's just growing education efforts going on with members of Congress and figuring out how we do this. Now, if you get too prescriptive, and you know this as an economist, and you're never going to be able to track the changes in the innovations and the capitalism and what we see. So you just have to find some way to put it. And we've done it in the past, and I think we can do it again. I've tried to make this. I have the 25 recs at the end, but I also have over 100 cartoons, Mark.
I was wondering about that. The 25. You've got 12. You lay out 12 problems. 1, 2, 3, 4, yeah. 5, 12, and then you have 25 solutions. And I was going to ask you, are they rank ordered in any particular way? They're not ranked.
Well, no, I put them in the groups of the things that the Congress should do, taking responsibility first ourselves. Things that a president can do, which includes who they put in charge of things. And the Biden administration put some pretty interesting out-of-the-box thinkers like Tim Wu in the White House and Lina Khan at the FTC, and we're waiting the antitrust head. And Merrick Garland, by the way, is an expert on antitrust. He used to teach it. He understands it. And then the third thing are these out-of-box ideas. And then the final thing is on its own what regular citizens can do, including, getting my book, but it's also about the groups you can sign up to get their alerts. There are, asking your member of Congress, what are you doing about this? It's really concerning. That still works, calling, emailing, and just looking at how you can buy local and buy small and make sure that you're continuing to focus on that. But I have an interesting background for this. I'm more in the middle of our party, but I've worked in the private sector. But I think there's a reason you have see someone like Mark Warner on my bill right now, because he gets it. He believes in capitalism. And if you believe in capitalism, you have to start being worried about what's happening right now.
Totally agree. Hey, I got an out of the box idea for you. I'm just
going to
say, privacy bank. There should be a bank that banks our data. And if they want the data, they got to pay us for it. So just saying.
There you go.
There you go.
It's the same concept as trying to put monetize what they're getting out of us for free. Yes. So when you send an email to someone about, I need a ceiling fan, and then suddenly you're seeing ads on ceiling fans forever. Yes.
They got to pay you. Yeah. I was going to say, the one idea I thought was really cool, and it's kind of simple when you think about it, but really cool, is you put the burden of proof back on the company. So if I have a merger, a big merger, yeah, right now the burden of the proof is on the Justice Department to say, hey, this is anti-competitive, but you're putting that burden back onto the companies that are merging. I thought that was a pretty cool idea.
It is, and I just did it for my suggestion is for the bigger ones, and actually Megan Delreheim's really interested in this, the former head of the DOJ under Trump antitrust. Yeah. And there's been a lot of interest in that. And that would be just a little more of a chisel to all this. Now, I think the companies with the deals would say, oh, it's a huge deal. But it's just trying to find ways, because given the sad sack record with the courts right now, you're trying to move this back to where it used to be in the glory days of antitrust and make antitrust cool again.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also like, even though I like, it's the name of my book, I do suggest changing it to competition policy. I liked having it the name because, one, it's a truth right now. Two, the word antitrust is a bit of a metaphor for what's going on in our country when it comes to institutions. And three, my good debate rival and actual friend, Pete Buttigieg, put out a book this fall called Trust.
Oh.
So I thought I'd have one called Antitrust, so we could continue our rivalry. No,
it's fine. It makes sense. Hey, I'm going to go to the audience in just a second. But I want to ask one other question, and I can't remember what it was. It was a good
question. Oh, that's cool. I'll just make one up.
No, wait. Oh, bummer. I really had a good question. Oh, it'll come back to
you. Go to the audience and you could come back to it. Because you do not have a monopoly on questions. Really bad antitrust jokes.
It's very true. Very true. Oh, by the way, I like competition policy. If I were, you know, your publisher, I think I would have gone with that.
Yeah, well, that word's a little boring on its own, but this looks sort of dramatic, you know.
Yeah, true. From the Gilded Age. There you go.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So here's a question from Sean.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is an example of a quote unquote good big company, and what is an example of a bad big company?
Okay. I think there's plenty of good companies. I'm not going to like start picking as a member of the Senate. That might seem a little weird. But you have a lot of areas in which I think you all know that where you have a lot of competition, and you have companies that are doing things like doing really great things for their employees. They get rated on that. I think that's really important about their family leave and what they're doing with wages and things like that, which is important part of this. People forget that monopolies isn't just about the price for consumers' innovation. It's also about, if you have one company to buy stuff from, there's not as much, or to work for, there's not as much of an incentive for competition when it comes to wages. So that's one thing. And again, I'm not going to also single out one bad company, but I think, you know, okay, I'll single out the one at the beginning of my book, which was later sold to a Danish company, so who cares, but it was a company called Ovation, and they were the ones that literally decided it was okay to jack up the baby's heart valve drugs from $85 to $1,600 a treatment, costing children's hospitals all over the country hundreds of millions of dollars, costing parents. And the sad part, and why I wrote the book, is that even though the FTC brought a major case against them, they were joined by attorney generals, state attorney generals in red and blue states, because of the state of the law, somehow a judge found that it was okay to own both baby heart drugs and jack up the prices. After about 5 years, a generic came into being. But over that 5-year period, the taxpayers, the government, individual families, children's hospitals already cash strapped, never got their money back, of course. And so that's what happens all the time. And I have a particular place in my heart of anger about these pharma companies that have jacked up the price because they can on vulnerable populations.
Yeah. Do you think, given what the pharmas did during the pandemic and their yeoman work around the vaccine, does that have any bearing on your thinking here?
Well, first of all, they did incredible work. Americans, people all over the world did incredible work developing this vaccine. And but you can't still stop from pushing on these competition issues. That's how I look at it. And not every company's bad, but you've got, or I wouldn't be have been in the private sector myself for a long time. But David Cicilline just did a hearing. I testified over in the House. You had Cornyn testifying. Senator Cornyn, Senator Grassley testified. We all talked about our proposals, which includes things like buying less expensive drugs from other countries and safely reimporting them, allowing Medicare, which the president made a big deal about in the State of the Union, I thought, on Medicare negotiation for all our seniors, making sure generic, something that Senator Lee and Senator Leahy and Grassley and many others and I have worked on with making sure that they have the samples generics do to develop their products, stopping the practice of pay for delay, where big companies are paying off their competitor generics to keep their products off the market. I think when people hear that, they're like, seriously, that happened. So I believe that there was some incredible work done by pharmaceutical companies and individual scientists all over the world. And that will never change my belief of that. But I still believe in competition. And when you see bad stuff, you got to call them on it. And then usually in when it works and enforcement actions are brought, it reins it in and it doesn't give the whole industry a black eye.
Yeah, absolutely. Another question from the audience. What do you think about the Trump administration's decision to sue Google, you know, there at the end?
Mm-hmm. It was the right one. And that was out of the Justice Department. The FTC sued Facebook. So they kind of split them up. And the Trump administration, I have a part in this by the book about the crazy stories of Donald Trump in the past, where he was an owner of this new football league and he ended up being a witness in trial. It's pretty crazy. But he unfortunately had a moment, I mean, the way he talked about it, where he could have really taken this on, but instead he politicized it. And, you know, he hated one deal because CNN was part of it. That was a problem. Nevertheless, there were these career people working hard and there were people in charge that knew what they were doing in the antitrust division and FTC with Chairman Simon and Megan Delraheim. And they took on these big cases. Now, did they have enough resources? They would tell you no way, because to really move forward on the cases, you're going to have all kinds of help to win them, basically. And what the Simon did with the Facebook case, he waited till after the election, and he had a bunch of AGs on Democratic and Republican. But I think both cases have merit. I have asked questions. I asked the CEO of Google what his response was to things about monopolies at a hearing on their on some of the monopoly behavior they're showing of exclusionary conduct. And he said, well, he'd look into it, he's monitoring. And I said, I think there's been a response. It's the lawsuit. That was like, they sent you a response right there. And I think that's what the Biden administration now will be able to walk into what will be and is a bipartisan effort. I think it was really important that the Trump people brought those cases, even though it was at the end of the term and maybe they should have done it earlier. Then it makes it so it's not a partisan lawsuit.
Yeah, I guess that's a key point with the Trump antitrust suit, is that this is, and you make this a point in your book, this is bipartisan. This is not a partisan. Mm-hmm. So you have legislation that you've put forward that I don't think it includes all 25 of your proposals, but I guess the ones that Congress can do are in that bill. Yeah.
Right.
And so how's it going? So can you give us
we really do have a great moment on Thursday, and I'm sure not everyone was watching the judiciary hearing, but we had a contentious discussion about a nominee and I was pleased she got through, but it was on a party line vote. And then we turned to this, and there were a lot of people making statements that they thought it was time. There could have been a lot of shenanigans with that bill because, you know, I would have loved to attach my entire bill to the merger fee bill, but I didn't, because we had to start somewhere. And so we got that through, which bodes well for it getting through on the floor. The other piece about it is that we have a newspaper bill that's really important. Senator Kennedy and I have done that. Cicilline and Buck have it over in the House. And that allows the newspapers to negotiate together. It's an exemption, actually, for a 5-year period with the tech companies so that they can, and other news organizations, it's the Australia issue, so that they can be compensated rightfully and have the kind of access they should. Because as we know, it's one of the contributing factors, and I think they would say a very major one, to their declining state. And we cannot get rid of investigative reporting, and it won't be good enough just to have big national ones, as good as they may be. You need to have local. How else are you going to look into city councils or what's happening with a local business or a local water issue if you don't have the reporters on the ground?
I'm just going to read this question. It's a little lengthy.
Those are the best kind.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a shift. One argument I often hear, this is from Devin, is that monopolies don't exist anymore because there's competition across sectors. For instance, Amazon competes with Netflix and Walmart and grocery stores and more. How should we update our sense of what a monopoly is given the change companies look?
Sure. So you can look at different markets. There may well be competition in certain markets where Amazon's playing, or where Google has a company. That's a whole nother story. There may well be competition in certain markets, but that doesn't mean you say that it's okay, because there's a lot of markets. I just told the whole App Store story where there's a strong argument that there isn't competition. I just don't buy that. When that particular product is so unique, where you don't really have another way to do it if you're wanting to compete on the marketplace. That's why we keep using this term gatekeepers. They're the gatekeepers in controlling how you access a certain part of the market. They may not be the gatekeepers on another piece of it, but they are in a broad swath of the economy. And so that's how I look at it. And I get what the questioner is asking, and I agree. There could be different ways you look at things. Another thing which you as an economist would see is, you know, people say, well, we're competing internationally. So, oh, wow, that's a, but I don't think that means we want to become China, right? And say, oh, we're competing internationally, so we only have one company that does it. Mm-hmm. I think we are the leaders here with our economy in so many ways. We have so much control. And when Mark, you asked, well, why didn't what Europe does make a difference? Well, they're kind of been on their own for a long time there. And when the rest of the world is now looking at things and starting to say, wait a minute, we love these companies that they're American companies, but it doesn't mean we just have to sign off on everything they do. I think one example was what happened in Australia when a lot of us here stood up with Europe and said, wait a minute, this is wrong, and took it on and supported the Australians in what they were trying to do. This is international in scope, and everyone should want competition. And so we're going to have to look at trade agreements, note the difference in the support that the USMCA got from the Democratic side when some changes were made, yes, on the labor side, but also on the pharma agreement side. There was a change there that was really important to me about how long they could have certain control patents and things that had been changed from the original agreement. So I think you'll also see trade agreement negotiations going on that will matter for monopolies. And that means working with our allies on this.
Got it. Well, I guess presumably, at least in theory, you could have one company in an industry here if it's competing against massive companies in 10 different countries all over the globe, right? So banking comes to mind, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got massive German banks, Canadian banks, you know, Chinese banks. So you could presumably have a couple big banks here. Although I guess in the banking system, you've got 5,000 small banks too, so.
Right. Well, they've been, you know, those numbers have been decreasing in part with economy scale. And I'm a big supporter of these small community banks. So actually, my state has a lot of them. One of the interesting finance issues that I raise in the book, which is kind of thorny to get through, and there's a lot of research going on within Harvard, a professor there on this, but it is cross ownership of companies. So you can have and Warren Buffett recently, he sold this his stock in these, but he owned major stock in all the top airlines, right? So the work is being done of looking at, and yet you don't want to stop small institutions, small investors, but you have a few investors that can, that have major, major control over competitors in an economy, which is sounding a little like the trusts of old. So I think that piece of finance is really thorny, but it's one of, I raise this in the book and kind of go through the studies of what he does and suggest that we look at it more, because the solution, he has some solutions that I've included in there, but that's where the finance piece of it gets pretty interesting.
Yeah, actually, yeah,
horizontal shareholding.
You got these huge mutual funds, like, well, yeah. Everybody knows who they are. There's some, one of them is just headquartered just around the corner here.
Yes, I guess.
They're the biggest shareholders in every company in every industry, really. So yeah. they're passive, but, you know, maybe at some point in the future, they're not.
Yeah, so you should look at this work there. It's pretty interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. We're getting close to the end here.
I would like to note that, as because you're an economist, you like numbers, we've only lost 9 people. Not that I'm counting. I've been looking at the participants, so people have stuck with us
this whole conversation. Is that right? Oh yeah,
we didn't even lose them at horizontal shareholding. That was pretty good.
That's pretty amazing. Actually, some of the questions are pretty good here, but I don't know. We'll get to them all, but here's another one.
I can do one more, I think, because I gotta run.
So, okay, one more.
That's good.
In terms of what individuals can do, do you believe by unionizing, employees are able to somewhat tame the power of a monopolized industry?
Yes. And again, history, while the Midwesterners and the Minnesotans and people in Iowa were out there with their pitchforks of farmers because they were mad because their grain prices and other things were controlled by monopolists, you had in Chicago what was a peaceful strike and turned into called the Haymarket Massacre. You had a lot of these, the Pullman strike, a lot of these involved Gilded Age monopolists, and the unions were coming up trying to get better wages, trying to help their employees, and all of that was happening at the same time. And unions tend to give leverage to a group of disparate employees that don't have the clout of employer, especially a monopoly employer. There have been some actual antitrust suits about wages and things like this. One of the more interesting ones, again, Silicon Valley, was this was a while back, when Apple, they made an agreement not to hire each other's people. And so that involved in a lot of fines in certain areas. I can't remember what the job was, but they had agreed not to hire each other's people, and that was found to be a violation of the law. So all of that, again, I think unions, when you look at the numbers, when unions are strong, the workers' wages and the economy is strong. And that is another factor I discuss in the book. And there's been historically interest on the labor side in antitrust, also interest from NAACP, because if you're new players on the block, if you're people of color or you are a woman and you're trying to start a business, you can start it. Oh, good luck. So you can start it. But it's very hard to grow if there's a monopoly in the room. So that's another thing to think about.
Well, Senator, thank you so much. You've been very gracious with your time. And, you know, I just want to let you know, I'm a huge fan, even more now with the book. It's a great book.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. This was really a great discussion. Thank you so much. I literally am just thinking of Philadelphia right now and my time there and how much I like it, too. And I can't wait to get back. I got to do the Democratic Party of Pennsylvania once, and I was very, very excited because I thought, oh, where am I going to be? What historic building when I do this? And it was at the King of Prussia Mall.
Oh, no, you're kidding.
With Bob Casey, but it was a great event. And of course, I was there for the convention and many other times. So very good. We'll be back soon. Thank you. Thanks to the library.
Take care. Thank you, Free Library.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.